Jericho Road is a podcast and a Sunday school class and a ministry of St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Birmingham, Alabama. These days, we're covering all the books of the Bible in a class that we're calling Bible Basics. Most people want to read the Bible, but just don't know how. Let's see if we can help. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Jericho Road and a semester that we're calling Bible Basics. We decided some time ago that most people want to read the Bible, but we really need to learn how, and we need to learn what these books mean or what these stories mean and who these people actually are. In our last podcast, we talked about Genesis 1 through 11. Genesis 1 through 11 as a prehistory or a part one, if you will, with the story of us really beginning with Genesis chapter 12 and forward and the calling of Abraham to go be different in the way that God asked him to be different. So if Genesis 1 through 11 is a part 1, I'd like for this class to be a part 2, which means that Genesis, the bulk of Genesis, is about the patriarchs, these original families, if you will, that began this family, different of all the other families on the earth, and by extension through Christ, is our family. However, I want to pick one guy. I want to talk about Jacob. And the reason why I want to talk about Jacob is because we know more about Jacob than almost anybody else in Scripture. Jacob is the one guy you know from birth and then childhood and then teenage years, young adulthood, mature, and even to old age. Jacob is found in Scripture from Genesis 25 to 50. So outside of Jesus, Jacob is really the guy you can learn about. And I also want to talk about Jacob because this is really interesting. Much of what we know about Jacob is not pretty. And I can certainly relate to that, right? Jacob's got his own clay feet. And I'm going to begin this story of Jacob with a well that you can find today in a place called Beersheba, which is where Isaac and his family settled. Let me tell you how the Holy Land works, and especially these earliest stories. The place of the nation of Israel today roughly follows biblical lines in terms of its borders. And Israel today sits between Egypt in the south and Mesopotamia in the north, two what we would call water dynasties or agricultural powers because they have a lot of water. The Egyptians have the Nile River for irrigation, and then the Mesopotamians have the two rivers. It's called the Land of the Rivers. And then in between is this place where desert peoples, today would be Bedouins, and this is exactly who the patriarchs would be, would wander back and forth, north and south, between these two places. And this will all make sense in just a minute, but Beersheba's down in the Negev Desert, and it's under the sphere of Egypt. And you can travel there today, and you can see a well, and I'm going to read just a few verses from Genesis chapter 26, and then we'll tell you what it means. This is Genesis 26, 23. This is Isaac settling down. But from there, Isaac went up to Beersheba, and the very night the Lord appeared to him and said, I'm the God of your father Abraham. Do not be afraid, for I'm with you, and I will bless you, and I will make your offspring numerous for my servant Abraham's sake. And so he built an altar there on the name of the Lord, and he pitched his tent there, and then Isaac's servants dug a well. Well, what makes this well so sad, first of all, the well represents permanence, and it just represents the fact that they believe that God's going to make them a home. But what makes the well poignant is that when Isaac is settling down and preparing for a long, happy life and a long, happy family, he couldn't have known that something terrible had just happened. A few verses before, Jacob and Esau meet in the field, and Esau sells his birthright. Now, you may remember this story from your Sunday school days, but I'll just simply recap it. Jacob was a cook, and Jacob was his mother's favorite, but Jacob was the second son born. They were twins. And as the second son, he doesn't have the inheritance. Esau has the inheritance. Esau is a man of the field, and he's a hunter, and he's his father's favorite. But Esau also lives in the moment, and he comes in from the field hungry, famished, and Jacob has cooked a savory stew, which he knows will entice his brother. And Esau says, what have you got there? Give me some of that stew, for I will die. And Jacob says, sure, I'll give you some of my home-cooked chili, but you've got to give me your inheritance first. You've got to give me your birthright. Well, Esau didn't think a thing about it. He's like, well, what use is a birthright to me? Give me some of that soup, right? And so he eats his fill and forgets all about it. Esau forgot. Jacob never did. So in Genesis 27, which is the next chapter after the digging of the well, the trickster Jacob, and his name means trickster. Jacob means trickster or tripper upper. Okay, he tricks his old blind father who's near death into giving him the blessing, thinking that he's Esau. But it's a trick, and in their world, words matter, and they can't be taken back. So the blessing, which means the inheritance, which means the family name, which means the line of succession, if you will, has now been transmitted to the wrong child, and Jacob knows it. Worse yet, Esau discovers that this has happened, and suddenly it throws Esau into a murderous rage. Jacob has to leave. He knows his brother will kill him. And so as he's on the run from his brother, things begin to happen to this new patriarch in the line. Now, I'm going to pause right here and ask a question. Why Jacob? Why the trickster, right? Why the tripper upper? And the quick answer is that Jacob is, yes, very, very far from perfect, but Jacob could grow. Esau lived in the moment and lived by his appetites. And I have something that I like to teach couples when I prepare them for marriage in my church. We go over the service together and we always have giggles when we talk about, you know, does anyone show just cause why these two people may not be married? Speak now, else ever hold your peace. And we all laugh about what would happen if somebody would speak, because nobody ever does. It's just antique. And then I'll lead them through the vows. And I'll ask them, will you take this man or this woman to be your lawful wedded wife and to have and to hold and all those pretty things? And then we say, I will. Now, I do is a common response in many, many services, not ours. We say, I will. But we talk about how I do has almost become a wedding cliche, right? We go to the church to say our vows and our I do's, if you will. But I do is something immediate. I will is a long haul. I will is a commitment. I will is a promise to try. I will is a lifetime. And we might do anything in the moment. And this is exactly what Esau would do, right? I'll do it. I'll give you my birthright for a pot of chili. And so later on, we learn about Esau. He took foreign wives, which his parents ask him not to do. Not because God doesn't love other people, but because in this world, if you take a foreign person as your spouse, then you take on their ethics, right? Or you take on their idolatry. And so Esau becomes farther and farther and farther away from what had begun in Genesis chapter 12, which is to be a family apart, to be different in the way that God asks us to be different. He's not different at all. And his descendants would become another nation. They would be known as the Edomites. Now, I want to fast forward 2,000 years, and let's think of the Bible as a library. And so if we think about this story of Jacob being a story 4,000 years old, let's fast forward 2,000 years to the time of Jesus or the birth of Jesus. And some 40 years before Jesus' birth, there would be a client king to rule this land of Judea, this same promised land that God asked this family to be different in. This client king would rule Judea, and he was called Herod the Great. And he was not different in the way that God asked us to be different at all. He was more Roman than he was Jewish. But because he brought law and order, his Roman overlords gave him a title, King of the Jews, which no one else was ever allowed to have, which is ironic because he wasn't Jewish. His parents were converted from another nation. Herod the Great was vile. He executed his favorite wife and three of his children. And we get a snapshot of Herod the Great in Matthew's gospel right at the very beginning, right at Christmas time. And I'm going to read just a few verses. So here we've got this big library that covers thousands of years going from Genesis to Matthew. This is Matthew chapter 2, and it's the 16th verse. When Herod saw that he'd been tricked by the wise men, do you remember the story now? Wise men went to pay homage to Jesus. They called him a king. So Herod said, well, good, tell me where he's living and I'll pay homage too. Of course, he doesn't want to. When Herod saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, he was infuriated. And he sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had learned from the wise men. And this was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing in loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled because they are no more. Herod was evil. Herod would dispose of even his own family or all the children of an innocent city. Herod lived by his appetites, and Herod too was from Edom. That's the dot I want to connect here. Okay, Herod is a vision of a nightmare world and a nightmare king of what would have happened if Esau had gotten the blessing. So this is why Jacob is the patriarch. But first, when we read the stories in the book of Genesis, this first patriarch is on the run. Okay, I want to recap a scene really quickly, and I want to read a very famous verse to you, which is when Jacob has the dream of a ladder. This is the first time that Jacob's been away from home. He's away from his mama now. Mom and dad live way down in Beersheba. We've already sort of gotten a little bit of an idea of Egypt in the south and Mesopotamia in the north. Jacob goes to be with his mom's family way up in the north. It's 500 miles away from home, and he's in the mountains of what today is called Samaria, or actually, if you read the newspapers daily, it's what we now call the occupied West Bank. This is the West Bank that's being fought over with the settler movement and all that. So Bethel is a place where he goes, and it's a place where you can find today, and it's here where he has a dream. I'm going to read this to you, and we'll see if we can see this in a new way. This is Genesis chapter 28, beginning with the 10th verse. And we all know the song, right? We are climbing Jacob's ladder. Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he came to a certain place, and he stayed there for the night because the sun had set. And taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and laid it down in that place. And by the way, the Hebrew is written in such a way that probably he laid stones around him to protect him from night critters, not to use a stone for a pillow. And he dreamed that there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reaching to heaven. And the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And the Lord stood beside him and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. And the land on which you lie I will give you and your offspring. And your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth. And you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And all the families of the earth shall be blessed, and you and your offspring. Know that I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go. And I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. And Jacob woke up from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid, and he said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. Because he's in the north, he's near Mesopotamia. His family lives in the south, so they're under the Egyptian influence. But now Jacob is traveling to the north, and there was a common feature in their religion in the Mesopotamian world, and that was that of a ziggurat. What they would do is they would build a mound. So in Egypt, they would build a pyramid as part of their religion. In Mesopotamia, they would build a mound with a staircase on the side. So this ladder that we've translated is probably a ziggurat, probably something very familiar to people living in this part of the world. And what you would do with the ziggurat is you would simply worship the gods, the little g gods, that lived on the very top of the mountain, so that the staircase would enable you to ascend, okay, to climb up to the realm of the gods. But I want you to pay attention to a very, very important verse, which is verse 13 of Genesis chapter 28. And the Lord stood beside him and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham. So the Lord stands beside Jacob as he stares at the ziggurat, with angels and angels descending. Angels are messengers, really, of the heavenly realm. And I like what Rabbi Harold Kushner said, which these angels represent the Jacob who can be and the Jacob who's not yet. This is Jacob is looking at his own future of moving upwards and downwards, forwards and backwards, and growing all the while. And yet the Lord stands beside him at the bottom of the ramp, looking up, which means that God is not way off in the sky somewhere, but God is with him. And a key word, and I tried to read it this way so you could hear it, is the word place. How awesome is this place? When he stood in this place, and he had a dream in this place. And the word place is used six times in this short little story, which means that this is a very, very special place. God is with him here in this place. And he names it Bethel, which means Bethel, or the house of God. Now, I hope that we all have holy places. For many of us who have churches that we love, the church can be that holy place because it's a place where important things happen to us. I happen to have a neighbor who's in deep grief, an old man, because his church has been closed and deconsecrated and sold to a developer. And so this place now is suddenly going to have a parking lot over it and mixed-use retail, which might seem like progress, but not so much when you buried your wife in that place, right? I hope we all have places that we can return to, that are holy for us, you know, holy spaces that are there for us when we need them, right? The places where we had a dream or the places where God spoke to us. But that's only one lesson of Jacob's ladder. God stood beside him in that place, but God is also out there too. Jacob's a long way from home, and he's got lots of adventures that he's got to have, including wives and children, fits and starts with his own mom's family. And then at some point in Genesis 32, giving you a quick overview of the Jacob story, he decides he needs to face his past. He needs to face his family again. So he travels south. Remember the back and forth from the north and the south. He begins to travel south towards Edom, towards Esau. Esau then packs up and begins to head toward him as he hears that he's traveling. And Jacob's afraid. Again, he's alone. Again, he's in danger. Again, and it's night. Again, with another night event that could be a dream or could be something else. This is Genesis chapter 32, beginning with the 22nd verse. That same night he got in, he took his two wives, his two maids, and 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. The Jabbok is an east-west river that runs across the Jordan River, and so Esau, Edom, is heading north, and Jacob is heading south, and the two are going to meet. And he took them and sent them across the stream, and likewise everything that he had. And Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. And when the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he struck him on the hip socket. Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. And then he said, "Let me go, for day is breaking." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." Then he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And then the man said, "You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you've striven with God and with humans and have prevailed." So Jacob gets a new name. He gets a new name, Israel, and he's not Jacob anymore. He's not the tricker upper, but rather he's the striver. He's the struggler. And Jacob is a wrestler because he always has been a wrestler, right? He wrestled for his brother's birthright, and he wrestles for truth, and he wrestles to justify his behavior. And each time Jacob ends up wrestling, he ends up coming out ahead, except for this event. Was it an angel? Was it God himself? The story is written so mysteriously that we can never know. And I like what the old sages would say about Genesis itself. The very first word of Genesis that we call in the beginning is the Hebrew word Bereshit, which begins with the second letter of the alphabet, which means that in some cases, we're never going to know. The first letter of the alphabet is knowledge that is reserved for God alone. And so who knows who this heavenly being would have been, but he gets a name because this time when he struggles with God, it's a draw. He can't beat him. He can't outsmart him. All he can do is hang on to see that God was always with him. And that's the meaning of the name of the patriarch who would give Israel their name today. People who struggle for truth, people who struggle to know, people who struggle to do right in God's sight as God is with them and with us. And as St. Paul would wisely say in the back of our library that we call the Bible, in Christ, we get to call this our family too. We too are heirs of Israel. So at the very, very end of Jacob's long life that goes from Genesis 25 to Genesis 50, we learn that in Genesis 48, after fits and starts and his family now living in Egypt, remember the north-south thing, in Egypt because of a famine and because he's gathered with his children, once again, he thought he lost his favorite son, Joseph. They're reunited. He gets to see Joseph and bless his children, and he says this. This is Genesis 48, beginning with the 15th verse. And he blessed Joseph, and he said, "The God before whom my ancestors Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all harm, bless these boys, and in them let my name be perpetuated, and the name of my ancestors Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into multitude on the earth." God who has been the shepherd. In another 1,000 years, a shepherd boy who would be a king would also say, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." And at the end of this long life, Jacob could look back and be happy, for God was always with him, even imperfect people. So that, in a nutshell, is Jacob's life, but also the meaning of the larger book of Genesis. So I hope you enjoyed that. Stick with Bible basics, and next week we're going to go to a prophet, Jeremiah. Thanks, everybody. Once again, hey, everybody, and thank you for listening to this semester of Jericho Road podcast called Bible Basics. If you like what you're hearing, hey, do us a solid and go to your ratings there and give us 5 stars on your app rating, and also tell a friend. We want to keep this going, and we want to share the word. Once again, thanks so much. See you next time.